when a man is drawing on to a time of life where the two ends of life meet, when he finds himself, however hard he is, being wheeled about for the second time in a speech as a go-kart, he should be overjoyed to do a kindness if he can. He wants plenty. And I don't speak of myself particular, said Mr. Homer, because, sir, the way I look at it is that we're all drawing on to the bottom of the hill, whatever age we are, on account of time never standing still for a single moment. So let us always do a kindness and be over-rejoiced. To be sure. He knocked the ashes out of his pipe and put it on a ledge in the back of his chair, expressly made for its reception. There's Emily's cousin. Him that she was to have been married to, said Mr. Homer, rubbing his hands feebly. As fine a fellow as there is in Yarmouth. He'll come and talk or read to me in the evening for an hour together sometimes. That's a kindness, I should call it. All his life's a kindness. I'm going to see him now, said I. Are you? Said Mr. Homer. Tell him I was hearty and sent my respects. Minnie and Joram's at a ball. They would be as proud to see you as I am if they was at home. Minnie won't hardly go out at all, you see, on account of father, as she says. So I swore tonight that if she didn't go, I'd go to bed at 6. In consequence of which, Mr. Homer shook himself and his chair with laughter at the success of his device, she and Joram's at a ball. I shook hands with him and wished him good night. Half a minute, sir. If you was to go without seeing my little elephant, you'd lose the best of sights. You'd never see such a sight. Minnie! A musical little voice answered from somewhere upstairs. I'm a coming, grandfather! And a pretty little girl with long flaxen curling hair soon came running into the shop. This is my little elephant, sir, said Homer, fondling the child. Siamese breed, sir. Now, little elephant! The little elephant set the door of the parlour open, enabling me to see that, in these latter days, it was converted into a bedroom for Mr. Homer, who could not be easily conveyed upstairs, and then hid her pretty forehead and tumbled her long hair against the back of Mr. Homer's chair. "The elephant butts, you know, sir," said Mr. Homer, winking, "when he goes at an object. Once elephant, twice, three times. At this signal, the little elephant, with a dexterity that was next to marvellous in so small an animal, whisked the chair round with Mr. Homer in it and rattled it off pell-mell into the parlour without touching the doorpost, Mr. Homer indescribably enjoying the performance and looking back at me on the road as if it were the triumphant issue of his life's exertions. After a stroll about the town, I went to Ham's house. Peggotty had now removed here for good, and had let her own house to the successor of Mr. Barkis in the carrying business, who had paid her very well for the goodwill, cart, and horse. I believe the very same slow horse that Mr. Barkis drove was still at work. I found them in the neat kitchen, accompanied by Mrs. Gummidge, who had been fetched from the old boat by Mr. Peggotty himself. I doubt if she could have been induced to desert her post by anyone else. He had evidently told them all. Both Peggotty and Mrs. Gummidge had their aprons to their eyes, and Ham had just stepped out to take a turn on the beach. He presently came home, very glad to see me, and I hoped they were all the better for my being there. We spoke, with some approach to cheerfulness, of Mr. Peggotty's growing rich in a new country, and of the wonders he would describe in his letters. We said nothing of Emily by name, but distantly referred to her more than once. Ham was the serenest of the party. But Peggotty told me when she lighted me to a little chamber where the crocodile book was lying ready for me on the table, that he always was the same. She believed, she told me, crying, that he was broken-hearted. Though he was as full of courage as of sweetness, and worked harder and better than any boat-builder in any yard in all that part. There were times, she said, of an evening, when he talked of their old life in the boat-house, and then he mentioned Emily as a child, but he never mentioned her as a woman. I thought I'd read in his face that he would like to speak to me alone. I therefore resolved to put myself in his way next evening as he came home from his work. Having settled this with myself, I fell asleep. That night, for the first time in all those many nights, the candle was taken out of the window. Mr. Peggotty swung in his old hammock in the old boat, and the wind murmured with the old sound round his head. All next day he was occupied in disposing of his fishing boat and tackle, in packing up and sending to London by wagon such of his little domestic possessions as he thought would be useful to him, and in parting with the rest or bestowing them on Mrs. Gummidge. She was with him all day. As I had a sorrowful wish to see the old place once more before it was locked up, I engaged to meet them there in the evening. But I so arranged it as that I should meet Ham first. It was easy to come in his way, as I knew where he worked. I met him at a retired part of the sands, which I knew he would cross, and turned back with him that he might have leisure to speak to me if he really wished. I had not mistaken the expression of his face. We had walked but a little way together, when he said, without looking at me, "Master Davy, have you seen her?" "Only for a moment, when she was in a swoon," I softly answered. We walked a little farther, and he said, "Master Davy, shall you see her, do you think?" "It would be too painful to her, perhaps," said I. "I've thought of that," he replied. "So 'twould, sir. So 'twould." "But, Ham," said I gently, "if there's anything that I could write to her for you, in case I couldn't tell it, if there's anything you would wish to make known to her through me, I should consider it a sacred trust." "I'm sure, hon. I thank you, sir, most kind. I think there is something I could wish said or wrote." "What is it?" We walked a little farther in silence, and then he spoke. "'Tan't that I forgive her. Tan't that so much. 'Tis more as I beg of her to forgive me for having pressed my affections upon her. Odd times I think that if I hadn't had a promise for her to marry me, sir, she was that trustful of me in a friendly way, that she'd have told me what was struggling in her mind and would have counselled with me, and I might have saved her." I pressed his hand. "Is that all?" "There's yet something else," he returned, "if I can say it, Master Davy." We walked on, farther than we'd walked yet, before he spoke again. He was not crying when he made the pauses I shall express by lines. He was merely collecting himself to speak very plainly. "I loved her, and I love the memory of her. Too deep to be able to lead her to believe of my own self as I'm a happy man. I could only be happy by forgetting of her. And I'm afeard I couldn't hardly bear as she should be told I'd done that. But if you, being so full of learning, Master Davy, could think of anything to say as might bring her to believe I wasn't greatly hurt, still loving of her and mourning for her, anything as might bring her to believe as I was not tired of my life and yet was hoping for her to see her without blame, where the wicked cease from troubling and the weary are at rest, anything as would ease her sorrowful mind and yet not make her think as I could ever marry, or as 'twas possible that anyone could ever be to me what she was, I should ask of you to say that, with my prayers for her that was so dear." I pressed his manly hand again and told him I would charge myself to do this as well as I could. "I thank you, sir," he answered. "'Twas kind of you to meet me. 'Twas kind of you to bear him company down. Master Davy, I understand very well, though my aunt will come to London afore they sail, and they'll unite once more, that I'm not like to see him again. I fear to feel sure on. We don't say so, but so 'twill be, and better so. The last you see on him, the very last, will you give him the lovingest duty and thanks of the orphan, as he was ever more than a father to? This I also promised faithfully. I thank ye again, sir, he said, heartily shaking hands. I know where you're a-going. Goodbye. With a slight wave of his hand, as though to explain to me that he couldn't enter the old place, he turned away. As I looked after his figure crossing the waste in the moonlight, I saw him turn his face towards a strip of silvery light upon the sea and pass on, looking at it, until he was a shadow in the distance. The door of the boathouse stood open when I approached, and on entering I found it emptied of all its furniture, saving one of the old lockers, on which Mrs. Gummidge, with a basket on her knee, was seated looking at Mr. Peggotty. He leant his elbow on the rough chimney-piece, and gazed upon a few expiring embers in the grate. But he raised his head hopefully on my coming in, and spoke in a cheery manner. "Come according to promise to bid farewell today, Master Davy," he said, taking up the candle. "Bear enough now, ain't it?" "Indeed, you have made good use of the time," said I. "Why, we've not been idle, sir. Mrs. Gummidge has worked like a... I don't know what Mrs. Gummidge ain't worked like," said Mr. Peggotty, looking at her at a loss for a sufficiently approving simile. Mrs. Gummidge, leaning on her basket, made no observation. "That's the very locker that you used to sit on along with Emily," said Mr. Peggotty in a whisper. "I'm a-going to carry it away with me last of all. And here's your old little bedroom, see, Master Davy? Almost as bleak tonight as art could wish." In truth, the wind, though it was low, had a solemn sound, and crept around the deserted house with a whispered wailing that was very mournful. Everything was gone, down to the little mirror with the oyster-shell frame. I thought of myself lying here when that first great change was being wrought at home. I thought of the blue-eyed child who had enchanted me. I thought of Steerforth. And a foolish, fearful fancy came upon me of his being near at hand and liable to be met at any turn. "'Tis like to be long," said Mr. Peggotty in a low voice, "afore the boat finds new tenants. I look upon down here as being unfortunate now." "Does it belong to anybody in the neighbourhood?" I asked. "To a mastmaker up town," said Mr. Peggotty. "I'm going to give the key to him tonight." We looked into the other little room and came back to Mrs. Gummidge sitting on the locker, whom Mr. Peggotty, putting the light on the chimney-piece, requested to rise, that he might carry it outside the door before extinguishing the candle. "Dan'l," says Mrs. Gummidge, suddenly deserting her basket and clinging to his arm. "My dear Dan'l, the parting words I speak in this house is I mustn't be left behind. Don't you think of leaving me behind, Dan'l? Oh, don't you ever do it!" Mr. Peggotty, taken aback, looked from Mrs. Gummidge to me and from me to Mrs. Gummidge, as if he'd been awakened from a sleep. "Don't ye, dearest Dan'l, don't ye!" cried Mrs. Gummidge fervently. "Take me long with you, Dan'l. Take me long with you and Emily. I'll be your servant, constant and true. If there's slaves in them parts where you're a-going, I'll be bound to you for one and happy. But don't you leave me behind, Dan'l, that's a deary dear." "My good soul," said Mr. Peggotty, shaking his head, "you don't know what a long voyage and what a hard life 'tis." "Yes, I do, Dan'l. I can guess," cried Mrs. Gummidge. "But my parting words under this roof is I shall go into the house and die if I'm not took. I can dig, Dan'l. I can work. I can live hard. I can be loving and patient now more than you think, Dan'l, if you'll only try me. I wouldn't touch the allowance, not if I was dying of want, Dan'l Peggotty. But I'll go with you and Emily if you'll only let me to the world's end. I know how 'tis. I know you think that I'm lone and lorn, but, dearie love, "'Tain't so no more. "'I ain't sat here so long a-watching "'and a-thinking of your trials "'without some good being done me. "'Master Davy, speak to him for me. "'I knows his ways and Emily's, "'and I knows their sorrows "'and can be a comfort to him some odd times "'and labour for em allus. "'Dan'l, dearie, Dan'l, let me go long with you.' "'And Mrs. Gummidge took his hand "'and kissed it with a homely pathos and affection "'in a homely rapture of devotion and gratitude "'that he well deserved. "'We brought the locker out, extinguished the candle, "'fastened the door on the outside, "'left the old boat close shut up, a dark speck, in the cloudy night. Next day, when we were returning to London outside the coach, Mrs. Gummidge and her basket were on the seat behind, and Mrs. Gummidge was happy. Chapter 52. I assist at an explosion. When the time Mr. Micawber had appointed so mysteriously was within 24 hours of being come, my aunt and I consulted how we should proceed, for my aunt was very unwilling to leave Dora. Ah, how easily I carried Dora up and downstairs now! We were disposed, notwithstanding Mr. Micawber's stipulation for my aunt's attendance, to arrange that she should stay at home, and be represented by Mr. Dick and me. In short, we had resolved to take this course, when Dora again unsettled us by declaring that she never would forgive herself, and never would forgive her bad boy, if my aunt remained behind on any pretence. "'I won't speak to you,' said Dora, shaking her curls at my aunt. "'I'll be disagreeable. I'll make Jip bark at you all day. I shall be sure that you really are a cross old thing if you don't go.' "'Tut, Blossom!' laughed my aunt. "'You know you can't do without me.' "'Yes, I can,' said Dora. "'You're no use to me at all. "'You never run up and downstairs for me all day long. "'You never sit and tell me stories about Dodie "'when his shoes were worn out and he was covered with dust. "'Oh, what a poor little mite of a fellow! "'You never do anything at all to please me, do you, dear?' "'Dora made haste to kiss my aunt and to say, "'Yes, you do. I'm only joking.' "'Lest my aunt should think she really meant it. "'But, aunt,' said Dora coaxingly. "'Now listen. You must go. I shall tease you till you let me have my own way about it. I shall lead my naughty boy such a life if he don't make you go. I shall make myself so disagreeable, and so will Jip. You'll wish you had gone like a good thing for ever and ever so long if you don't go. Besides,' said Dora, putting back her hair and looking wonderingly at my aunt and me, "'why shouldn't you both go? I'm not very ill indeed, am I?' "'Why, what a question!' cried my aunt. "'What a fancy!' said I. "'Yes, I know I'm a silly little thing,' said Dora, slowly looking from one of us to the other, and then putting up her pretty lips to kiss us as she lay upon her couch. "'Well, then, you must both go, or I shall not believe you, and then I shall cry.' I saw in my aunt's face that she began to give way now, and Dora brightened again as she saw it too. "'You'll come back with so much to tell me "'that it'll take at least a week to make me understand,' said Dora. "'Because I know I shan't understand for a length of time "'if there's any business in it. "'And there's sure to be some business in it. "'If there's anything to add up besides, "'I don't know when I shall make it out, "'and my bad boy will look so miserable all the time. "'There, now, you'll go, won't you? "'You'll only be gone one night, and Jip will take care of me while you're gone. "'Dodie'll carry me upstairs before you go, and I won't come down again till you come back. "'And you shall take Agnes a dreadfully scolding letter from me, because she's never been to see us.' "'We agreed, without any more consultation, that we would both go, "'and that Dora was a little impostor, who feigned to be rather unwell because she liked to be petted. "'She was greatly pleased and very merry, "'and we four, that is to say my aunt, Mr. Dick, Traddles and I, "'went down to Canterbury by the Dover Mail that night. "'At the hotel where Mr. Micawber had requested us to await him, which we got into with some trouble in the middle of the night, I found a letter importing that he would appear in the morning punctually at 9:30. After which we went shivering at that uncomfortable hour to our respective beds through various closed passages, which smelt as if they'd been steeped for ages in a solution of soup and stables. Early in the morning I sauntered through the dear old tranquil streets, and again mingled with the shadows of the venerable gateways and churches. The rooks were sailing about the cathedral towers, and the towers themselves, overlooking many a long unaltered mile of the rich country and its pleasant streams, were cutting the bright morning air as if there were no such thing as change on earth. Yet the bells, when they sounded, told me sorrowfully of change in everything. Told me of their own age, and my pretty Dora's youth, and of many never old who had lived and loved and died, while the reverberations of the bells had hummed through the rusty armour of the Black Prince hanging up within, and motes upon the deep of time had lost themselves in air as circles do in water. I looked at the old house from the corner of the street, but didn't go nearer to it, lest, being observed, I might unwittingly do any harm to the design I'd come to aid. The early sun was striking edgewise on its gables and lattice windows, touching them with gold, and some beams of its old peace seemed to touch my heart. I strolled into the country for an hour or so, and then returned by the main street, which, in the interval, had shaken off its last night's sleep. Among those who were stirring in the shops, I saw my ancient enemy the butcher, now advanced to top boots and a baby, and in business for himself. He was nursing the baby, and appeared to be a benignant member of society. We all became very anxious and impatient when we sat down to breakfast. As it approached nearer and nearer to 9:30, our restless expectation of Mr. Micawber increased. At last we made no more pretence of attending to the meal, which, except with Mr. Dick, had been a mere form from the first, but my aunt walked up and down the room, Traddles sat upon the sofa affecting to read the paper with his eyes on the ceiling, and I looked out of the window to give early notice of Mr. Micawber's coming. Nor had I long to watch, for at the first chime of the half hour he appeared in the street. "Here he is," said I, "and not in his legal attire." My aunt tied the strings of her bonnet. She had come down to breakfast in it, and put on her shawl, as if she were ready for anything that was resolute and uncompromising. Traddles buttoned his coat with a determined air. Mr. Dick, disturbed by these formidable appearances, but feeling it necessary to imitate them, pulled his hat with both hands as firmly over his ears as he possibly could, and instantly took it off again to welcome Mr. Micawber. "Gentlemen and madam," said Mr. Micawber, "good morning. My dear sir," to Mr. Dick, who shook hands with him violently, "you are extremely good." "Have you breakfasted?" said Mr. Dick. "Have a chop." "Not for the world, my good sir," cried Mr. Micawber, stopping him on his way to the bell. "Appetite and myself, Mr. Dixon, have long been strangers." Mr. Dixon was so pleased with his new name, and appeared to think it so very obliging in Mr. Micawber to confer it upon him, that he shook hands with him again and laughed rather childishly. "Dick," said my aunt, "attention." Mr. Dick recovered himself with a blush. "Now, sir," said my aunt to Mr. Micawber, as she put on her gloves, "we are ready for Mount Vesuvius or anything else as soon as you please." "Madam," returned Mr. Micawber, "I trust you will shortly witness an eruption. Mr. Traddles, I have your permission, I believe, to mention here that we have been in communication together." "It is undoubtedly the fact, Copperfield," said Traddles, to whom I looked in surprise. "Mr. Micawber has consulted me in reference to what he has in contemplation, and I have advised him to the best of my judgment." "Unless I deceive myself, Mr. Traddles," pursued Mr. Micawber, "what I contemplate is a disclosure of an important nature." "Highly so," said Traddles. "Perhaps under such circumstances, madam and gentlemen," said Mr. Micawber. "You will do me the favour to submit yourselves for the moment to the direction of one who, however unworthy to be regarded in any other light but as a waif and stray upon the shore of human nature, is still your fellow man, though crushed out of his original form by individual errors and the accumulative force of a combination of circumstances." "We have perfect confidence in you, Mr. Micawber," said I, "and will do what you please." "Mr. Copperfield," returned Mr. Micawber, "your confidence is not, at the existing juncture, ill bestowed. I would beg to be allowed a start of 5 minutes by the clock, and then to receive the present company inquiring for Miss Wickfield at the office of Wickfield and Heap, whose stipendiary I am." My aunt and I looked at Traddles, who nodded his approval. "I have no more," observed Mr. Micawber, "to say at present." With which, to my infinite surprise, he included us all in a comprehensive bow and disappeared, his manner being extremely distant and his face extremely pale. Traddles only smiled and shook his head, with his hair standing upright on the top of it, when I looked to him for an explanation. So I took out my watch and, as a last resource, counted off the 5 minutes. My aunt, with her own watch in her hand, did the like. When the time was expired, Traddles gave her his arm, and we all went out together to the old house without saying one word on the way.
This ends side 2 of cassette 23 of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 24.
We found Mr. Micawber at his desk, in the turret office on the ground floor, either writing or pretending to write hard. The large office ruler was stuck into his waistcoat, and was not so well concealed but that a foot or more of that instrument protruded from his bosom like a new kind of shirt frill. As it appeared to me that I was expected to speak, I said aloud, "How do you do, Mr. Micawber?" "Mr. Copperfield," said Mr. Micawber gravely, "I hope I see you well." "Is Miss Wickfield at home?" said I. "Mr. Wickfield is unwell in bed, sir, of a rheumatic fever," he returned. "But Miss Wickfield, I have no doubt, will be happy to see old friends. Will you walk in, sir?" He preceded us to the dining room, the first room I'd entered in that house, and flinging open the door of Mr. Wickfield's former office, said, in a sonorous voice, "Miss Trotwood, Mr. David Copperfield, Mr. Thomas Traddles, and Mr. Dixon." I'd not seen Uriah Heep since the time of the blow. Our visit astonished him, evidently. Not the less, I dare say, because it astonished ourselves. He did not gather his eyebrows together, for he had none worth mentioning, but he frowned to that degree that he almost closed his small eyes, while the hurried raising of his grisly hand to his chin betrayed some trepidation or surprise. This was only when we were in the act of entering his room, and when I caught a glance at him over my aunt's shoulder. A moment afterwards, he was as fawning and as humble as ever. "Well, I'm sure," he said, "this is indeed an unexpected pleasure. To have, as I may say, all friends round St. Paul's at once is a treat unlooked for. Mr. Copperfield, I hope I see you well, and, if I may humbly express myself, so friendly towards them as is ever your friends, whether or not. Mrs. Copperfield, sir, I hope she's getting on. We've been made quite uneasy by the poor accounts we have had of her state lately, I do assure you." I felt ashamed to let him take my hand, but I didn't know yet what else to do. "Things are changed in this office, Miss Trotwood, since I was a numble clerk and held your pony, ain't they?" said Uriah, with his sickliest smile. "But I am not changed, Miss Trotwood. Well, sir, returned my aunt. "To tell you the truth, I think you are pretty constant to the promise of your youth, if that's any satisfaction to you." "Thank you, Miss Trotwood," said Uriah, writhing in his ungainly manner, "for your good opinion. Micawber, tell him to let Miss Agnes know, and Mother will be quite in a state when she sees the present company," said Uriah, setting chairs. "You're not busy, Mr. Heap," said Traddles, whose eye the cunning red eye accidentally caught, as it at once scrutinized and evaded us. "No, Mr. Traddles," replied Uriah, resuming his official seat and squeezing his bony hands laid palm to palm between his bony knees. "Not so much so as I could wish, but lawyers, sharks, and leeches are not easily satisfied, you know. Not but what myself and Micawber have our hands pretty full, in general, on account of Mr. Wickfield being hardly fit for any occupation, sir. But it's a pleasure as well as a duty, I'm sure, to work for him. You've not been intimate with Mr. Wickfield, I think, Mr. Traddles. I believe I've only had the honour of seeing you once myself." "No, I have not been intimate with Mr. Wickfield," returned Traddles, "or I might perhaps have waited on you long ago, Mr. Heap." There was something in the tone of this reply which made Uriah look at the speaker again with a very sinister and suspicious expression. But seeing only Traddles with his good-natured face, simple manner, and hair on end, he dismissed it as he replied, with a jerk of his whole body, but especially his throat, "I am sorry for that, Mr. Traddles. You would have admired him as much as we all do. His little failings would only have endeared him to you the more. But if you would like to hear my fellow partner eloquently spoken of, I should refer you to Copperfield. The family is a subject he's very strong upon, if you never heard him." I was prevented from disclaiming the compliment, if I should have done so in any case, by the entrance of Agnes, now ushered in by Mr. Micawber. She was not quite so self-possessed as usual, I thought, and had evidently undergone anxiety and fatigue. But her earnest cordiality and her quiet beauty shone with the gentler lustre for it. I saw Uriah watch her while she greeted us, and he reminded me of an ugly and rebellious genie watching a good spirit. In the meanwhile, some slight sign passed between Mr. Micawber and Traddles, and Traddles, unobserved except by me, went out. "Don't wait, Micawber," said Uriah. Mr. Micawber, with his hand upon the ruler in his breast, stood erect before the door, most unmistakably contemplating one of his fellow men, and that man his employer. "What are you waiting for?" said Uriah. "Micawber, did you hear me tell you not to wait?" "Yes," replied the immovable Mr. Micawber. "Then why do you wait?" said Uriah. "Because I, in short, choose," replied Mr. Micawber with a burst. Uriah's cheeks lost colour, and an unwholesome paleness, still faintly tinged by his pervading red, overspread them. He looked at Mr. Micawber attentively, with his whole face breathing short and quick in every feature. "You are a dissipated fellow, as all the world knows," he said with an effort at a smile, "and I'm afraid you'll oblige me to get rid of you. Go along. I'll talk to you presently." "If there is a scoundrel on this earth," said Mr. Micawber, suddenly breaking out again with the utmost vehemence, "with whom I have already talked too much, that scoundrel's name is Heap." Uriah fell back as if he'd been struck or stung, looking slowly round upon us with the darkest and wickedest expression that his face could wear, he said in a lower voice, "Oh, this is a conspiracy. You have met here by appointment. You are playing booty with my clerk, are you, Copperfield? Now take care. You make nothing of this. We understand each other, you and me. There's no love between us. You were always a puppy with a proud stomach from your first coming here, and you envy me my rise, do you? None of your plots against me. I'll counterplot you. Micawber, you be off. I'll talk to you presently." "Mr. Micawber," said I, "there is a sudden change in this fellow in more respects than the extraordinary one of his speaking the truth in one particular, which shows me that he's brought to bay. Deal with him as he deserves." "You are a precious set of people, ain't you?" said Uriah, in the same low voice, and breaking out into a clammy heat, which he wiped from his forehead with his long, lean hand. "To buy over my clerk, who is the very scum of society. As you yourself were, Copperfield, you know it before anyone had charity on you, to defame me with these lies. Miss Trotwood, you had better stop this, or I'll stop your husband shorter than will be pleasant to you. I won't know your story professionally for nothing, old lady. Miss Wickfield, if you have any love for your father, you had better not join that gang. I'll ruin him if you do. Now come! I've got some of you under the harrow. Think twice before it goes over you. Think twice, you, Micawber. If you don't want to be crushed, I recommend you to take yourself off and be talked to presently, you fool, while there's time to retreat. Where's Mother?" he said, suddenly appearing to notice with alarm the absence of Traddles and pulling down the bell rope. "Fine doings in a person's own house!" "Mrs. Heep is here, sir," said Traddles, returning with that worthy mother of a worthy son. "I have taken the liberty of making myself known to her." "Who are you to make yourself known?" retorted Uriah. "And what do you want here?" "I am the agent and friend of Mr. Wickfield, sir," said Traddles in a composed, business-like way. "And I have a power of attorney from him in my pocket to act for him in all matters." "The old ass has drunk himself into a state of dotage," said Uriah, turning uglier than before, "and it has been got from him by fraud." "Something has been got from him by fraud, I know," returned Traddles quietly, "and so do you, Mr. Heep. We will refer that question, if you please, to Mr. Micawber."
"Yuri,"
Mrs. Heap began with an anxious gesture. "You hold your tongue, Mother," he returned. "Least said, soonest mended."
"But, my Yuri..."
"Will you hold your tongue, Mother, and leave it to me?" Though I had long known that his civility was false, and all his pretences knavish and hollow, I had had no adequate conception of the extent of his hypocrisy until I now saw him with his mask off. The suddenness with which he dropped it when he perceived that it was useless to him, the malice, insolence, and hatred he revealed, the leer with which he exulted even at this moment in the evil he had done, all this time being desperate too, and at his wit's end for the means of getting the better of us, though perfectly consistent with the experience I had of him, at first took even me by surprise, who had known him so long and disliked him so heartily. I say nothing of the look he conferred on me as he stood eyeing us, one after another, for I had always understood that he hated me, and I remembered the marks of my hand upon his cheek. But when his eyes passed on to Agnes, and I saw the rage with which he felt his power over her slipping away, and the exhibition in their disappointment of the odious passions that had led him to aspire to one whose virtues he could never appreciate or care for, I was shocked by the mere thought of her having lived an hour within sight of such a man. After some rubbing of the lower part of his face, and some looking at us with those bad eyes over his grisly fingers, he made one more address to me, half whining and half abusive. "You think it justifiable, do you, Copperfield? You who pride yourself so much on your honour and all the rest of it, to sneak about my place, eavesdropping with my clerk? If it had been me, I shouldn't have wondered, for I don't make myself out a gentleman, though I never was in the streets either, as you were, according to Micawber. But being you, and you're not afraid of doing this either, you don't think at all of what I shall do in return, or of getting yourself into trouble for conspiracy and so forth. Very well. We shall see. Mr. What's-your-name, you were going to refer some question to Micawber. There's your referee. Why don't you make him speak? He's learnt his lesson, I see." Seeing that what he said had no effect on me or any of us, he sat on the edge of his table with his hands in his pockets, and one of his splay feet twisted round the other leg, waiting doggedly for what might follow. "Mr. Micawber," whose impetuosity I had restrained thus far with the greatest difficulty, and who had repeatedly interposed with the first syllable of "Stone!" Troll, without getting to the second, now burst forward, drew the ruler from his breast, apparently as a defensive weapon, and produced from his pocket a foolscap document folded in the form of a large letter. Opening this packet with his old flourish, and glancing at the contents as if he cherished an artistic admiration of their style of composition, he began to read as follows. "Dear Miss Trotwood and gentlemen." "Bless and save the man," exclaimed my aunt in a low voice. "He'd write letters by the ream if it was a capital offence." Mr. Micawber, without hearing her, went on. "In appearing before you to denounce probably the most consummate villain that has ever existed..." Mr. Micawber, without looking off the letter, pointed the ruler like a ghostly truncheon at Uriah Heep. "I ask no consideration for myself, the victim from my cradle of pecuniary liabilities to which I have been unable to respond. I have ever been the sport and toy of debasing circumstances. Ignominy, want, despair, and madness have, collectively or separately, been the attendants of my career." The relish with which Mr. Micawber described himself as a prey to these dismal calamities was only to be equalled by the emphasis with which he read his letter, and the kind of homage he rendered to it with a roll of his head when he thought he'd hit a sentence very hard indeed. "In an accumulation of ignominy, want, despair, and madness, I entered the office, or as our lively neighbour the Gaul would term it, the bureau, of the firm nominally conducted under the appellation of Wickfield and Heap, but in reality wielded by Heap alone. Heap, and only Heap, is the mainspring of that machine. Heap, and only Heap, is the forger and the cheat." Uriah, more blue than white at these words, made a dart at the letter, as if to tear it in pieces. Mr. Micawber, with a perfect miracle of dexterity or luck, caught his advancing knuckles with the ruler and disabled his right hand. It dropped at the wrist as if it were broken. The blow sounded as if it had fallen on wood. "The devil take you," said Uriah, writhing in a new way with pain. "I'll be even with you. Approach me again, you heap of infamy," gasped Mr. Micawber, "and if your head is human, I'll break it. Come on, come on." I think I never saw anything more ridiculous. I was sensible of it, even at the time, than Mr. Micawber making broadsword guards with the ruler and crying, "Come on!" while Traddles and I pushed him back into a corner, from which, as often as we got him into it, he persisted in emerging again. His enemy, muttering to himself after wringing his wounded hand for some time, slowly drew off his neckerchief and bound it up, then held it in his other hand and sat upon his table with his sullen face looking down. Mr. Micawber, when he was sufficiently cool, proceeded with his letter. "These stipendiary emoluments, in consideration of which I entered into the service of Heap," always pausing before that word and uttering it with astonishing vigour, "were not defined beyond the pittance of 22 shillings and 6 per week. The rest was left contingent on the value of my professional exertions. In other and more expressive words, on the baseness of my nature, the cupidity of my motives, the poverty of my family, the general moral, or rather immoral, resemblance between myself and Heap. Need I say that it soon became necessary for me to solicit from Heap pecuniary advances towards the support of Mrs. Micawber and our blighted but rising family. Need I say that this necessity had been foreseen by Heap, that those advances were secured by IOUs and other similar acknowledgements known to the legal institutions of this country, and that I thus became enmeshed in the web he had spun for my reception? Mr. McCormick's enjoyment of his epistolary powers in describing this unfortunate state of things really seemed to outweigh any pain or anxiety that the reality could have caused him. He read on, "Then it was that Heep began to favour me with just so much of his confidence as was necessary to the discharge of his infernal business. Then it was that I began, if I may so Shakespeareanly express myself, to dwindle, peak, and pine. I found that my services were constantly called into requisition for the falsification of business and the mystification of an individual whom I will designate as Mr. W. That Mr. W. was imposed upon, kept in ignorance, and deluded in every possible way. Yet, that all this while, the ruffian, Heep, was professing unbounded gratitude to and unbounded friendship for that much-abused gentleman. This was bad enough, but, as the philosophic Dane observes, with that universal applicability which distinguishes the illustrious ornament of the Elizabethan era, worse remains behind." Mr. Micawber was so very much struck by this happy rounding off with a quotation that he indulged himself and us with a second reading of the sentence under pretence of having lost his place. "It is not my intention," he continued, reading on, "to enter on a detailed list within the compass of the present epistle, though it is really elsewhere, of the various malpractices of a minor nature affecting the individual whom I have denominated Mr. W., to which I have been a tacitly consenting party. My object, when the contest within myself between stipend and no stipend, baker and no baker, existence and non-existence ceased, was to take advantage of my opportunities to discover and expose the major malpractices committed to that gentleman's grievous wrong and injury by Heep. Stimulated by the silent monitor within, and by no less touching and appealing monitor without, to whom I will briefly refer as Miss W., I entered on a not unlaborious task of clandestine investigation, protracted now, to the best of my knowledge, information, and belief, over a period exceeding 12 calendar months." He read this passage as if it were from an Act of Parliament, and appeared majestically refreshed by the sound of the words. "My charges against Heep," he read on, glancing at him and drawing the ruler into a convenient position under his left arm in case of need, "are as follows." We all held our breath, I think. I'm sure Uriah held his. "First," said Mr. Micawber, "when Mr. W.'s faculties and memory for business became, through causes into which it is not necessary or expedient for me to enter, weakened and confused, Heep designedly perplexed and complicated the whole of the official transactions. When Mr. W. was least fit to enter on business, Heep was always at hand to force him to enter on it. He obtained Mr. W.'s signature under such circumstances to documents of importance, representing them to be other documents of no importance. He induced Mr. W. to empower him to draw out thus one particular sum of trust money amounting to 12, 6, 14, 2, and 9, and employed it to meet pretended business charges and deficiencies which were either already provided for or had never really existed. He gave this proceeding throughout the appearance of having originated in Mr. W.'s own dishonest intention, and of having been accomplished by Mr. W.'s own dishonest act, and has used it ever since to torture and constrain him." "You shall prove this, you Copperfield," said Uriah with a threatening shake of the head, "all in good time. Ask Heep, Mr. Traddles. Who lived in his house after him? Said Mr. Micawber, breaking off from the letter. Will you? The fool himself. And lives there now, said Uriah, disdainfully. Ask Heep if he ever kept a pocketbook in that house, said Mr. Micawber. Will you? I saw Uriah's lank hand stop involuntarily in the scraping of his chin. Or ask him, said Mr. Micawber, if he ever burnt one there. If he says yes and asks you where the ashes are, refer him to Wilkins Micawber, and he will hear of something not at all to his advantage. The triumphant flourish with which Mr. Micawber delivered himself of these words had a powerful effect in alarming the mother, who cried out in much agitation, Yuri, Yuri, be humble and make terms, my dear. Mother, he retorted, will you keep quiet? You're in a fright and don't know what you say or mean. Humble, he repeated, looking at me with a snarl. I've humbled some of them for a pretty long time back, humble as I was. Mr. Micawber, genteelly adjusting his chin and his cravat, presently proceeded with his composition. Second, Heep has, on several occasions, to the best of my knowledge, information and belief, but that won't do, muttered Uriah, relieved. Mother, will you keep quiet? We will endeavour to provide something that will do, and do for you finally, sir, very shortly, replied Mr. Micawber. Second, Heep has, on several occasions, to the best of my knowledge, information and belief, systematically forged to various entries, books and documents, the signature of Mr. W., and has distinctly done so in one instance capable of proof by me, to wit in manner following, that is to say. Again, Mr. Micawber had a relish in this formal piling up of words, which, however ludicrously displayed in his case, was, I must say, not at all peculiar to him. I have observed it in the course of my life in numbers of men. It seems to me to be a general rule. In the taking of legal oaths, for instance, deponents seem to enjoy themselves mightily when they come to several good words in succession for the expression of one idea, as that they utterly detest, abominate, and abjure, or so forth, and the old anathemas were made relishing on the same principle. We talk about the tyranny of words, but we like to tyrannize over them, too. We're fond of having a large, superfluous establishment of words to wait upon us on great occasions. We think it looks important and sounds well. As we're not particular about the meanings of our liveries on state occasions, if they be but fine and numerous enough, so the meaning or necessity of our words is a secondary consideration, if there be but a great parade of them. And as individuals get into trouble by making too great a show of liveries, or as slaves when they are too numerous rise against their masters, so I think I could mention a nation that has got into many great difficulties, and will get into many greater, from maintaining too large a retinue of words. Mr. Micawber read on, almost smacking his lips, to wit, in a manner following, that is to say, Mr. W. being infirm, and it being within the bounds of probability that his decease might lead to some discoveries and to the downfall of Heep's power over the W. family, as I, Wilkins Micawber, the undersigned, assume, unless the filial affection of his daughter could be secretly influenced from allowing any investigation of the partnership affairs to be ever made, the said Heep deemed it expedient to have a bond ready by him, as from Mr. W., for the before-mentioned sum of 12,614,209, with interest stated therein to have been advanced by Heep to Mr. W. to save Mr. W. from dishonour, though really the sum was never advanced by him, and has long been replaced. The signatures to this instrument, purporting to be executed by Mr. W. and attested by Wilkins Micawber, are forgeries by Heep. I have in my possession, in his hand and pocketbook, several similar imitations of Mr. W.'s signature, here and there defaced by fire, but legible to anyone. I never attested any such document, and I have the document itself in my possession." Uriah Heep, with a start, took out of his pocket a bunch of keys and opened a certain drawer, then suddenly bethought himself of what he was about, and turned again towards us without looking in it. "And I have the document," Mr. Micawber read again, looking about as if it were the text of a sermon, "in my possession. That is to say, I had, early this morning when this was written, but have since relinquished it to Mr. Traddles."
"It's quite true," assented Traddles.
Yuri, cried the mother, "be humble and make terms. I know my son to be humble, gentlemen, if you'll give him time to think. Mr. Copperfield, I'm sure you know that he was always very humble, sir."
It was singular to see how the mother still held to the old trick when the son had abandoned it as useless.
"Mother," he said, with an impatient bite of the handkerchief in which his hand was wrapped, "you had better take and fire a loaded gun at me."
"But I love you, Yuri," cried Mrs. Heep,
and I have no doubt she did, or that he loved her, however strange it may appear, though to be sure they were a congenial couple.
"And I can't bear to hear you provoking the gentleman and endangering of yourself more. I told the gentleman at first, when he told me upstairs it was come to light, that I would answer for your being humble and making amends. Oh, see how humble I am, gentlemen, and don't mind him."
"Why, there's Copperfield, mother," he angrily retorted, pointing his lean finger at me, against whom all his animosity was levelled, as the prime mover in the discovery, and I didn't undeceive him. "There's Copperfield would give you £100 to say less than you've blurted out."
"I can't help it, Yuri," cried his mother. "I can't see you running into danger through carrying your head so high. Better be humble, as you always was."
He remained for a little, biting the handkerchief, and then said to me with a scowl, "What more have you got to bring forward? If anything, go on with it. What you look at me for?" Mr. Micawber promptly resumed his letter, only too glad to revert to a performance with which he was so highly satisfied. "Third and last, I am now in a condition to show by heaps false books and heaps real memoranda, beginning with the partially destroyed pocketbook, which I was unable to comprehend at the time of its accidental discovery by Mrs. Micawber, and now are taking possession of our present abode in the locker or bin devoted to the reception of the ashes calcined on our domestic hearth, that the weaknesses, the faults, the very virtues, the parental affections and the sense of honour of the unhappy Mr. W. have been for years acted on by and warped to the base purposes of heap. That Mr. W. has been for years deluded and plundered in every conceivable manner to the pecuniary aggrandisement of the avaricious, false, and grasping heap, that the engrossing object of heap was next to gain, to subdue Mr. and Miss W. Of his ulterior views in reference to the latter, I say nothing, wholly to himself. That his last act, completed but a few months since, was to induce Mr. W. to execute a relinquishment of his share in the partnership, and even a bill of sale on the very furniture of his house, in consideration of a certain annuity, to be well and truly paid by heap on the 4 common quarter days in each and every year. That these meshes, beginning with alarming and falsified accounts of the estate of which Mr. W. is the receiver, at a period when Mr. W. had launched into imprudent and ill-judged speculations, and may not have had the money for which he was morally and legally responsible in hand, going on with pretended borrowings of money at enormous interest, really coming from heap, and by heap, fraudulently obtained or withheld from Mr. W. himself, on pretence of such speculations or otherwise perpetuated by a miscellaneous catalogue of unscrupulous chicaneries, gradually thickened until the unhappy Mr. W. could see no world beyond. Bankrupt as he believed alike in circumstances, in all other hope and in honour, his sole reliance was upon the monster in the garb of man.
Mr. McCorker made a good deal of this as a new turn of expression,
who, by making himself necessary to him, had achieved his destruction. All this I undertake to show. Probably much more.
I whispered a few words to Agnes, who was weeping, half joyfully, half sorrowfully, at my side, and there was a movement among us as if